Everybody said don't, but we're going to do it anyway.
We're going to do it anyway.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater, a priestly look at some of your favorite musicals, with your hosts, cathedral deans and musical theater queens, Nathan LaRude and Peter Elliott.
This is the Gospel of Musical Theater. I'm Nathan.
I'm Peter. It's good to be back, Nathan. Gee whiz.
It's been a minute since we got to be on mic together to talk about our favorite subject, the world of American musical theater. Although a little bit of a slight departure for you and me. Well, not really a departure. We're expanding the universe of the podcast. How about that? Going a little further afield than we sometimes do, as opposed to treating a composer's works piece by piece,
right,
dot by dot, inch by inch, line by line, inch by inch, putting it together.
The art of making art is putting it together, bit by bit.
We really need all these musicians.
Link by link, making the connections, yes we do. Drink by drink, taking every comment as it comes. Learning how to play the politician like you play piano, bass and drums. Otherwise you'll find your composition isn't gonna get much exhibition. Art isn't easy. Every minor detail is a major decision. Have to keep things in scale, have to hold to your vision. What's a little cocktail conversation if it gets the funds for your foundation? Every time I start to feel defensive, I remember vinyl is expensive.
Now, would you agree to do an interview?
Maybe one. I'm building up the image.
That's kind of the whole nature of this podcast. But we are beginning a new series. We both have been taken with the new Barbra Streisand autobiography that was just published a couple months ago here in the U.S. Peter, you're a little more than halfway through. You're further ahead than I am.
I'm a little more than halfway through. My God, it goes on and on. This is
a weighty
piece. And I think as you've been listening to it, I've been reading it. So we've been having two different kind of experiences of her autobiography. And I think that's great. It was like, there is so much here that connects with some of the themes that we've been exploring in this podcast series. And she's such an important figure within musical theater herself.
Yeah. Well, musical theater and then also American, I mean, I shouldn't say just American.
The American Songbook.
The American Songbook for sure, yeah. Which is right next door to our podcast. A lot of overlap between the kind of the Great American Songbook and the music that was written for the stage. Also, I mean, I also want to put this on the table right away because it's something that I want to think about with you. She is a queer icon, Barbra Streisand.
Yes.
She at one point talks about how, famously an untrained voice. I think she studied once with a voice teacher who told her basically, like, don't change a thing. Don't let anybody teach you how to sing. Your natural technique is spot on. Don't let anybody change you. I think that was her only vocal lesson. But it sounds like Maria Callas is sort of one of the, that's kind of the lineage, I think, of Barbra. So one way we can kind of think about Barbra Streisand is she's in the, I would say, Maria Callas, Judy Garland, she's in that lineage. She's a belter.
Yeah.
She's a musical theater who then, you know, becomes one of the great divas. I think understands to a certain degree that she is certainly a gay icon, right? Like she's, and that was a very specific period in her career where the gays really kind of embraced her, but has become, I got the physical copy of the book because I sort of felt like as a gay man, this is one of my sacred texts. Like I need to, like it is incumbent upon me. I also admire Barbra Streisand a lot. I've always admired her. I don't know that I've... Do I love Barbra Streisand? You know, like I have an interest. I'm trying to. One of the things I want to think about is like, what is our relationship with her as an actor, as a singer, as a film director? She's had an incredible career, but a lot of it in dialogue with what I want to call sort of musical theater culture, queer culture. She's an interesting figure that way, and I want to tease out like what she represents in American popular culture, Northwestern popular culture.
She's a singing actor, right?
Yeah.
In a great tradition, Callas, Merman, Bernadette Peters, probably Callas and Bernadette Peters.
Sarah Bernhardt, she talks about her kind of fixation. I guess she wasn't a singer, I don't think. But very much kind of, in the American female actress tradition. That's kind of where she locates herself.
And not only theatrically, but every song that she ever approaches, she approaches as a method actor, wanting to discover the inside story there, finding a way to tell it, and even wanting to play with the harmonies and the melody line. If she thinks a song should go up when the composer has it going down, she has no hesitation. So just to your piece about her being a gay icon, I think part of it is her complete commitment to expressing herself, whoever she is, which I think a lot of us queer folk understand that, you know, everybody says don't, culture says don't, and yet we know we have to bring forth this identity that is so strong in us that it can't be resisted.
Yeah, she's a little bit extra. Her style is, it's certainly not minimalist. She is not afraid of, I mean, sometimes, you know, there's a way in which I feel like her career, at a certain point, she becomes almost a little bit of a camp icon. You know, like there was a period where I think, and this is kind of how I first discovered Barbra Streisand, which is somebody that people didn't quite take seriously, right? Yeah. Like she, especially I would say the albums. Some of them have aged well. Some of them, I think, have aged better than maybe. Some of them are just plain odd because she makes strange choices and sometimes I feel like gets in her own way, you know, just in terms of the expressiveness, the incredible theatricality of her. You know, it's like I went back last night and watched a couple clips of the Central Park concert, you know, the Happening in Central Park concert. And at one level, it's like I get a sense of why she was so incredible to experience in the flesh. I mean, people who like this last summer have gone to see Beyonce and Taylor Swift in sports stadiums, right? Like, I mean, something is just the incredible magnetism of the physical presence of this performer, the charisma that she brings to the stage. That doesn't always translate onto an album, right? She, or even onto a film, you know, she can be a little over the top. She can be a little baroque. Right. She can be a little intense. And sometimes, you know, like just skating this side of camp, she's not afraid to be with an incredible sense of earnestness, right? So it's sometimes, you know, like she's easy to laugh at. There's a level at which she's not always, I don't think, as self-reflexive or as in touch with her own bigness as you almost kind of want her to be. And some of it, it's like she's a huge star. Why should she? She's a, you know, like Barbra Streisand is a juggernaut.
Right. She doesn't disappear into a song or into a role. Right?
It's always Barbra Streisand.
It's always Barbra Streisand. Yep. So even though there's this, well, maybe it is part of method acting. I don't know. I mean, if you have to find within yourself everything that you're going to express as an actor, then you're all, everything you manifest on the stage is going to grow out of, in some way, your identity.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I want to think about with you as we kind of explore her oeuvre over these next couple of, at least her musical theater adjacent oeuvre, which is not everything she's ever done. But that's one of the pieces I want to think about, because her training in method acting, my sense is like, method acting is not just the sort of reigning school of how certainly American actors were trained, although it is. I mean, that's kind of basically a version of method acting was what I got in high school drama classes, right? Like, I think that's what a lot of us, that it is sort of the mainstream American training school for actors. There is, it is actually in some ways kind of an interesting, I mean, I almost want to call it a theology of human experience, right? Which is, right. It's in some ways like very kind of, my sense is kind of based in therapy and therapeutic models, which is the individual by mining their own past. Sense memory has a lot to do with this, right? Like recalling often particularly traumatic experiences in order to, I mean, to be able to cry on cue or to be able to fall apart on cue, or I think about like Shelley Duvall in The Shining, like scream in terror for, you know, for a whole day while takes are being done. You have to be able to mine your own personal experiences of trauma and kind of metabolize them. So, I mean, there is a way in which, yeah, everything, every part she plays is a little bit of Barbra Streisand. That's how she was taught, right? Everything yes. has to connect with something that she has experienced or that she can access kind of in her body in order to find the emotion that she needs to be able to play. And at one level, I think that's, I mean, you know, like that's method acting, right? She's a good method actor in the way that Brando and Meryl Streep and, you know, like the great American actors were, this is kind of the, whether they're kind of retreating from it or Leonardo DiCaprio famously, right? Like the version of this is like actually living as your character for the entirety of the film shoot and not coming out of it, which is why I think method acting has a little bit of a bad reputation right now, because it tends to be kind of big heroic men who do big heroic things and mess themselves up and are impossible to live with for the purity of their art. I don't think she's quite that intense. She can turn it off at the end of the day and go home and spend time with her husband and her kids. But method acting is your own personality is the only thing that you have. And actually, I mean, you're like, I had a mentor who basically said that about the priesthood to me once, right? Like, you know, Nathan, you're the only thing that you have to use as a minister is you. Your only tool in right. ministry is you. So there's right. a way in which I feel like method acting is kind of an interesting way of thinking about a lot. I mean, even those of us who are not actors, it's a very particular way of being in the world, but it is very much based in my understanding, my own psychology and my right. trauma. And to a certain degree, we might call this almost a sort of wounded healer, artist as a kind of priest, artist as a sacred human being set apart in order to enact some sort of ritual, liturgical function. An actor who's trained in the method, anyway, draws on his or her kind of individual trauma and offers that to the world kind of as a form of healing. So there's something really fascinating to me about how she understands her training, her identity as an actor, which I want to, you know, I want to kind of put right next to her identity as a politician, or at least somebody who's very interested in politics, as a yeah. prophet. She understands herself as a creator, certainly. But there's a way in which I almost want to see Barbra Streisand as like, she's making a little bit of a bid to be an American secular priest. And I want to take her seriously on those yeah. on those terms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I have all sorts of thoughts about that. I have so many thoughts. I have so many questions.
So many questions.
Like, one is absolutely the connection with ministry. I had a similar message from my CBE supervisors who are saying the only instrument that a pastor has is the instrument of themselves, right? So yeah, that, needing to draw out of ourselves, I guess the difference is that in ordained ministry and maybe in the spiritual life generally, it's this interplay between wanting to express who I am authentically, absolutely, and being in touch with the energy and spirit of the true and living God. And that kind of dialogue that goes on internally that I think Christian community, Muslim community, Jewish community, spiritual practice, whatever kind, seek to bring those two things. Who I am as a child, a divine being, child of God. You know, we are not spiritual beings on a human journey, or is it the other way around? We right. are not human oh, no, beings that... on a spiritual journey. We are spiritual beings on a human journey.
Yeah. Yeah. Who said that? Is that?
That's Tyre de Chardin.
Okay, thank you. I was going to say, is that Richard Rohr? Like, which of our pop theologians is that? I guess he's a little more than a pop theologian.
Yeah. So you know, so that interplay of spirit and identity. When it comes to Barbra, who I agree is a priest, an artist within American, North American culture, actually within world culture, she is
world culture.
She
yep,
transcends North America yep. for sure. When it comes to the spirit, it is this odd kind of, well, I'm calling it odd, so that's judgmental. It's this, if you think it, it will manifest. A kind of, I mean, from Everybody Says Don't, I believe in miracles, right?
Yes! Everybody says don't, everybody says can't, everybody says wait around for miracles. That's the way the world is made. I insist on miracles. If you do them, miracles,
power of thought, the power of mind, kind of the 19th century discovery of energy, the Norman Vincent Peale world, the Robert Schuller world. It's more than the power of positive thinking, but it's somewhere wrapped up in that.
It's somewhere in that realm. Yeah, it's the piece about her that I also find, I mean, at one level I can dismiss it as like, oh, that sounds like Hollywood celebrities, you know, who get into Kabbalah and sort of weird esoteric versions of vaguely theosophical thinking.
Theosophical,
and to a certain degree, Barbara Streisand is incredibly successful and has a lot of money. And I think a piece of her justification for why she has been so successful is this can happen to anybody if they just believe in themselves in the way that I believed in myself. And there's a piece of me that wants to say, whoa, bullshit. And there's a piece of me that wants to say, that's fascinating, actually, as a very powerful woman at the top of her profession who has had to fight like a banshee to get there. So there's a piece of me that wants to say, yeah, okay, I will take you on your own terms. And I think you're right. Her functional theology, and she talks about, in interviews, she said for years she got it from George Bernard Shaw's book on Henrik Ibsen, the Norwegian playwright. And then in the autobiography, she says, actually, I went back and reread the book that I had read as a 15-year-old, the something of Ibsenism, the philosophy of Ibsenism. I don't remember the book. It's like
and
an essay
couldn't
that
find the
that
quote.
She couldn't find the quote. So there's a way in which I think she kind of says, well, that's pretty typical of me. I guess it's actually just, you know, like this is what I pulled from this book that doesn't actually say this thing. I think it is thought transcends matter. For years, for her entire career, Barbara Streisand, I think, has been trotting that line around, right? I read it when I was 15 years old. I was a young theater student. It kind of changed my life. And I think, as you say, that is her operational philosophy of certainly an artist, I would say a human being in the world, which is that thought has power, and by thinking something, I mean, this is the power of positive thinking in a certain kind of, right? It's a little more sophisticated than that. I think it's a little more grounded. I mean, you know, George Bernard Shaw is not, you know, he's a little more sophisticated than Robert Vincent Peale. He's at least a, you know, it's like a 19th century philosopher, pop psychologist. But I think that is kind of her justification for, you know, it's not that I was really lucky or had some good breaks. It's that I, as a 16-year-old, put this image of my, I thought, I dreamed a life for myself. I don't think she had all the particulars of it, but there's a way in which she's kind of using that philosophy as a way to take credit for her career. I thought this into being. I thought, I dreamed up Barbara Streisand, dropped that A from my name, B-A-R-B-R-A. I thought her into being, and I made this happen, right? I made this career happen.
And when it comes to a project like Yentl, for example, which we'll get to in a few weeks, it was her absolute determination that she had to make this film. Not only did she have to make it, but she had to make it in a very particular way. And not only did she have to make it in a very particular way, she had to direct it. And not only did she have to direct it, she needed to star in it. And not only did she need to star in it, but she needed to cast. And I guess this is another aspect that that comes out very clearly. Her need for absolute control over her projects as an artist. This is really, really huge for her. It makes her a difficult, she puts her in the category of a difficult person to work with.
A difficult collaborator.
A difficult collaborator. But also an incredible vision, and she will not allow any distractions or compromises to her vision about how this should be played out.
Yeah, you want to talk about the rewrite of putting it together that Stephen Sondheim did for her 1985 Broadway album?
Art isn't easy.
We gotta appeal to the kids.
Even when you're hot.
Why would you want to make an album like this anyway?
Advancing art is easy.
I think we gotta talk seriously about
financing
this.
Financing it is not.
Why take chances?
A vision's just a vision if it's only in your head.
Nobody respects your artistic integrity more than I do.
If no one gets to hear it, it's as good as dead.
You have to think about your career.
It has to come to life. Only way to make a work of art. Every moment makes a contribution. Every little detail plays a part. Having just the vision's no solution. Everything depends on execution. Putting it together, that's what counts. Ounce by ounce, putting it together. Small Small amounts adding up to make a work of art. First of all, you need a good foundation. Otherwise, it's risky from the start. Takes a little cocktail conversation, but without the proper preparation, having just the vision's no solution. Everything depends on execution. The art of making art is putting it together.
She talked to Sondheim about it. I know that. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's 1985. I think she's just finished up a record contract with Columbia, which took her down some dodgy recording rabbit holes in the late 70s and early 80s. Apparently her most successful album is the one she did with Barry Gibb, Guilt.
With Barry Gibbs.
Which I listened to this morning and thought, "Oh god, you've got to be kidding me." Barry Gibb and Barbra Streisand. But there they are, top the charts. And we got nothing to be guilty of. It is peak 1981. I wasn't there. You were.
I was probably
in utero, I think. I was in utero when this came out. But oh my god. So a couple years later, I think she's kind of ready to return to her roots. I think that's where the Broadway album comes from. And apparently then, the conversation that is memorialized in the very beginning of what would become the track, Putting It Together, is based in her experience having to fight her producers to do this album, right?
Right.
And what they're telling her is nobody wants a Broadway album from, like, that was 20 years ago. That was Funny Girl. It didn't sell that well in the beginning. You were already, I mean, you know, she begins her career as this weird throwback, right? She's a girl, she's 18, 19, 20. She's dressed up in the clothes of the 20s and 30s at a time when nobody was wearing that kind of stuff, certainly not, you know, on the stage of a supper club. She's doing Harold Arlen and Yip Harburg and, you know, music from the 20s and 30s. She's doing Sleepin' Bee. She's doing, you know, all of this kind of American songbook stuff at a time when the, you know, the artists of her generation were doing rock and roll. In the 80s, they tried to get Barbra Streisand to do rock and roll. Actually, she does a Bob Marley cover at one point, which is probably better not discussed.
Right.
Guava Jelly. It's a very, very uncomfortable
kind of like when Ethel Merman did Disco.
When Ethel Merman did Disco. Yeah, I think they're trying to do something very similar. Finally, by 1985, I think she's decided, you know what, like, that's just not my lane. Like, I want to go back to Broadway. That's my roots. Yeah. That's the music that made me want to be an actor and a singer. So she goes to Stephen Sondheim and says, hey, I think she had fallen in love with Sunday in the Park with George. You and I have talked about Sunday in the Park with George is, I think, every artist's favorite Sondheim musical, right?
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
all about art. And of course she identifies with this, right? Like this, it's in some ways, it's telling the story of Barbra Streisand's life on stage. So she says, I want to do Putting It Together from Sunday in the Park with George. Could it be about the record? Could it be about the record industry, not about the... And Sondheim's original quip was like, all you have to do is change lasers are expensive to vinyl is expensive. And the whole song basically works. And then as he thought about it a little more, he thought, well, actually, it is really about visual arts. I think I might... He basically completely rewrites Putting It Together. It is much more a new lyric for Barbra Streisand than it is an adaptation of the Broadway lyric. But it's all about the difficulty of getting an album. And actually, he says, you know, it's what interested Stephen Sondheim about Barbra Streisand's experience was, you know, in the context of the show, the artist does all of the work in an empty room and then puts his work on exhibition, and then the critics come in. Whereas, he says, the experience of Barbra is all of the critics nitpicking before she's put a note on, right? It's basically about her and her producers. Putting It Together, the Barbra Streisand version, is about all of the detractors that she has to deal with at the outset of a project, before she's even laid down a note in the studio, which is an interesting shift, right?
Yes.
To get all of that criticism from a bunch, and they're all men, right? Like, I mean, the song doesn't ever quite name the gender politics of her experience, but it absolutely records them, right? A bunch of men, you know, she was a big deal 20 years ago. She's kind of a, you know, like, we don't really know what to do with her. And then her, to your point, right, her deep commitment to her vision and her unwillingness to compromise on that vision, because vinyl is expensive, but she knows it sounds better on vinyl. So Sondheim wrote her, actually, I think a pretty good.
It's pretty good. And oh my God, she can sing Sondheim.
Yeah, she really does
she
well
really
with Sondheim.
She really can. She really can sing
Well, in some
Sondheim.
Ways, he's the perfect songwriter. I haven't gotten to the part in the book yet. I'm interested in to hear her talk about what in Sondheim's works. Because in some ways, like, he is the perfect theater artist for her, right? I mean, writing firmly in character, in voice, so giving her as an actor something to work with, characters that are specific and have clear, you know, have interesting motivations, deeply psychological. So, I mean, like, Streisand can approach a Sondheim. This is what she's been trained to do as a method actor, right? Like, what is this character? Who am I? What do I want? What are my objectives? And then these very specific lyrics that she can perform as an actor. She can find the part of herself and bring that to the table and you know, give a performance of a Sondheim lyric. She's a great interpreter of Sondheim.
She's a great interpreter. And, you know, I mean, one of the things that fascinates me about her is that she couldn't, funny girl, of course, she won everything. She made it a hit. It made her star. And we're going to talk about that, obviously, next week, next episode, I should say. She got tired of the business of replicating a performance on the same performance that, you know, once the previews are done, once the director says the show is set, then the actors need to go through exactly the same blocking, relationship, all that sort of stuff. Performance after performance, week after week, month after month. She did it with Funny Girl, and we'll talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Given that she is such an amazing actor, the Broadway stage, the theatrical world was not where she wanted to locate herself. She fell in love with film, because with film, you do it once. The camera's
very close.
It's the
immediacy of that. She doesn't like multiple takes. She's really
There's
a piece of me that, you know, I'm not an acting scholar. I will be very interested in that those bits though, because there's a piece of me almost wants to say, like, Barbra Streisand is an amazing performer. I don't know that, you know, it's like, as an act, there's a piece, when she was talking about her, you know, it's like the 3 years that she was doing Funny Girl on Broadway and then in London and how, and there's a piece of me that's like, yes, I get why that's frustrating to you. There's also a piece of me that wants to be like, yeah, you're still stuck in a kind of 16-year-old romanticized studio version of the method. Like, a professional Barbara shows up and does that every 8 shows a week for years. That is actually training. And if you were a better actor, you would figure out a way to be. And there's piece actually thinks, you know, it's like the number of times that she did Sleeping Bee at a supper, you know, it's like she did that song for years. And as a singer, she knows how to do that. It's always fresh. It's all, you know, it's like she's doing the same arrangement. And, you know, you can hear her do it in 1965 and hear her do it in 75. And basically, you know, like she's doing some similar things, but it's always grounded in the specificity of I am having this experience right now. And which is, you know, like what she's trained to do as an actor. So I know she knows how to do this, right? She knows how to take material that she's been performing for 30 years and make it fresh. Have it be in the moment. What am I experiencing right now in vocal riffs and a lyric that I've been singing for 30 years and are so deeply embodied in me that to a certain degree, it's like, yeah, she knows how to do this. She doesn't like doing it on the stage. Fair enough. That's her choice. But there is a way in which she's so fixated on having an experience in the moment.
Right.
At one level, I want to say, I think that's what makes her a good filmmaker. I think that's what makes her a poor stage actor. Maybe a pretty good song interpreter, cabaret artist. I don't know. I have mixed feelings on what I think about her as an actor, though. Like, I feel like there's a piece that she is pushing against that I want to say, like, yeah, that's, you know, if you had some better training, there's more tools in the toolbox than you are making available to you.
I mean, the word that comes, the phrase comes to mind is self-indulgent as a performer.
Yes. Yeah.
And I'm thinking about our vocations as priests. Like, we, week after week, month after month, season after season, year after year, you stand.
You pray the same darn Eucharistic prayer.
We stand at the altar. We say the same prayer. Yep. We have to bring authenticity to that moment. Although sometimes we're, you know, honestly,
sometimes
we're
you fake
not
it.
Feeling
and that's,
it.
And that's exactly, that's a piece of me that like finds this, it's like sometimes the emotion's not there. So your job is to fake it, right? Like you do need to somehow find a resource to, I mean, not fake it. That's not quite what I mean. But it's not about you and what you're feeling in
the
moment.
That's the point. Like, it's not about you for just the analogy. It's about the audience experience. You are serving the audience. You are there to enable the audience in theater to have an experience. Yep. Similarly, you're serving the assembled community, the congregation, when you're up front. And gosh, navigating the need for a strong ego to be able to, you know, put on the costume, put on the vestments, put on the clothes, go there when you're feeling shitty, when you're feeling great, when you're believing, you know, even more than St. Paul, and when you're doubting even more
when
than
you're a
Thomas,
functional atheist.
You know? You have to. I mean, whatever it is, you have to do it and get out there. Or some folks get out of, I mean, I remember in my, because here in the Canadian church, the dean is kind of vice president bishop. And so I had to sit in his office a number of times. And more than, I had about four occasions where priests came in who, the subject was, I want to renounce my orders. I want to no longer be ordained. There's a little process for that. It includes a conversation with the bishop or the bishop's designate. And I always admired those folks, like their deep authenticity that they could no longer play the part. And something had happened. And I had to resist, you know, saying, oh, come on, you know, you
right,
jolly
just
it all. Just fake it. Come on.
That's right.
But no, the authenticity of those folks. So, yeah, some folks can't do it.
Yeah. So is she a purer actor than, you know, like, I guess, I mean, we don't have to tease that apart. We don't have to make that judgment call. I am intrigued by this question, though, because with you, right, I also, both my training as an actor, but then my training as a priest, I have my own internal dialogue. When I hear her say, like, I can't do 8 shows a week for 3 years, there's a piece of me that thinks, like, well, shit, girl, I can't. You know, it's like you don't always feel it. So you figure out what, and I also recognize what you're saying is, you know, which is, it's like if you realize that you are doing that day after day, week after week, year after year, and it's not grounded in an actual experience. I mean, I think about like priests renouncing their orders, right? Like doing the discernment of, I no longer feel like I can do this with integrity. It is time for me to step aside. And as you say, there is deep integrity in that. There's something very beautiful and very honorable about saying, I no longer believe this. I feel like a fraud. I'm no longer comfortable putting on the clothes, being up there, saying these words and representing something that is so far removed from what I actually think, feel, and believe. I can't do this with integrity anymore. It's time for me to step aside. And I think, yeah, absolutely. And there's also a piece of me that's like, you know, the spiritual life, like it changes, you know, like I don't know. Like there's a piece of me that's like, there is something to the spiritual practice of faking it until you make it based in the hope that like, yes, even if this feels very dry and inauthentic, maybe for years, I'm trusting that there is some kind of through line here and that God has not abandoned me or that, you know, something has not abandoned me entirely. Right. And there will come a time when I actually can once again say these words with integrity, maybe in a deeper kind of way. Now, you know, everybody gets to, you know, do their own math on that question. That's, you know, I'm not advocating any of my colleagues to live a lie. But there is something in me that really respects another kind of professionalism, which is you don't always feel like doing it on any given day. Your job is to pray the prayer anyway, because it's not about you.
Well, and I think it was Fred Craddock, the biblical interpreter, wrote a lot of commentaries on scripture, who said something, as I recall, something like this, you know, this is the function of community. Like if my prayer life isn't great, and my prayer life generally isn't great, the reason I join in the a spiritual community, a Christian community in our case, is because the community prays. Somebody else's prayer will carry mine. There are times when I can't sing, especially when grief is, but the community sings. And I know when I've been particularly grieving or moved and you know, my voice fails me, I can't sing. But the song of the community carries on. I'm sort of carried by. And similarly, faith and belief. Like, I may not believe on a Sunday, but there's enough. It's about the community. Analogy. Similarly for the acting company, right? You've acted, I have too. And talking to my actor friends, like there's evenings, performances where it just isn't happening for them, but somebody else, I mean, they blank, they ghost, they can't remember the line. Somebody feeds it to them. It's a company working together. That is a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful thing in service of the audience, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think Barbara didn't really give a shit what was happening on stage. If she wanted to act in a particular way, she was going to, because that's how she wanted to express herself.
That's how
herself.
She felt in the moment. Yeah. Yeah. She's kind of a studio actor still in a lot of ways. I think what excites her is the energy of being, I mean, this is why I think she's so good on, why she, film is kind of her natural medium. Yeah. She's really good in a studio with one other actor and a good director who she feels like understands her process, sometimes will even give her line readings. She, you know, it's like it's fascinating to kind of watch her interact with mostly men. I think she's mostly been directed by men, and like who she respects. But I think that's kind of where she finds the most satisfying work is in a film studio with another actor to have an experience basically without an audience. Yeah. The camera is her audience. It needs to be as authentic and in the moment as possible. She wants the camera to be there on the first take because that's when the most interesting things happen. Yeah. And then she's done. Then she's ready to, like, turn the page. That's over. I don't ever want to return to that material again. I've had that experience.
And this connects with her stage fright, too. She couldn't go on stage. And, you know, now when she goes on stage, she has a teleprompter because lyric, you know.
Yep.
So what a crazy, creative, fabulous, flawed bundle of energy is Barbara Streisand.
She really is.
Streisand.
She's gonna write in and get very upset with you, Peter, if you mispronounce her name. She called Tim Cook of Apple and got him to change Siri's pronunciation. So if she can change Siri, Peter, she can change you.
I think so. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. But yeah. So we're gonna, over the next few episodes, take a deep dive into
certainly her musical material or her musical adjacent material. We're gonna look at Funny Girl, the role that defined, kind of brought her to prominence. She won all the awards for playing Fanny Bryce in Funny Girl. We're gonna look at Hello Dolly, which is
I'm so happy we're looking
I'm
at.
I'm so
Hello
excited.
Dolly.
So I mean, we're sort of using her as an excuse to talk about some shows that we haven't had a chance to talk about.
I want to talk to you about Hello Dolly for the last few
years. I can't wait to talk about Hello Dolly. Yes, I love Hello Dolly. I love Carol Channing in Hello Dolly. I love Ethel Merman in Hello Dolly. I actually really love Barbara Streisand in Hello Dolly.
Yes,
I'll out myself now as a fan of that film. I think that was probably the first. That was probably my first encounter with Barbara Streisand. I think I saw Hello Dolly. I'm going to guess I was probably 10, 11, 12. Yeah. And I don't think I really knew. I was probably vaguely aware of the name, but I did not know about Barbara Streisand before Hello Dolly. So that was my gateway. She is too young for the role. It's, you know, there's all kinds of criticisms of that film. It sounds like it was a miserable experience.
Miserable
for her.
Experience.
Not,
Gene
not happy
Kelly,
memories.
Walter
Gene
Matthau.
Kelly was awful. Walter Matthau was awful. Yeah. But I love that material. So we'll talk a little bit about Barbara in that show, and then we'll talk about Hello Dolly. I'm excited to talk about
Yent
on a clear day, which is I remember seeing a long time ago. I think I was in high school when I saw the film. I remember laughing at it. I think there's a scene where she's on a court stand and I remember saying, "My name is Melinda," and I just remember falling apart. Like, you've got to be kidding me! Who thought Barbara Streisand should play a whatever she's supposed to be, 18th century English courtesan? I think is who she is.
Well,
anyway.
In the crazy world of Alan J. Lerner, the magical that you know was already in Brigadoon. Once Frederick Lowe is out of has died, sadly, then he's working
his buffer of normalcy.
Oh boy,
he gets into some weird
and
shit.
We're playing with all sorts of parapsychology and reincarnation, all that stuff. And then
she
Yentl
tells a great story.
Yentl.
I'm
the way we were.
And the way we were. Right. So we're going to make a case for including the way we were on the Gospel of Musical Theater. Although the way we were is decidedly not musical theater. Does have one of her great songs in it. But we sort of feel like the work of Barbra Streisand, even the films that are not technically musicals, belong within the world of the show because they're all part of the lineage of American pop culture, which is really what we're interested in exploring theologically. And certainly nobody is more of a juggernaut when it comes to the world of American musical theater than Barbra Streisand and all of the ways in which that material has become such a cornerstone of musical theater culture, everything that she is and has done. And to the point of this show, we think, I'm saying this with a question mark in my voice, looking to you, my friend, to help find it. We think there's theological stuff.
Well, yeah, I think there's...
in this material.
Well, you know what? We'll find it even if it's not there.
We'll find it even if it's not there. We will insert it even if it cannot be pulled out. But yeah, I am interested. I mean, so some of the stuff around her who she is as an actor, who she is as a creator, to me that's an interesting doorway into thinking about what you and I do, right? Which is in many ways like this is the we exercise our creative muscles in service of priesthood, community, and God. She exercises her creative muscles in the service of art. And commerce, I suppose, to a certain degree, she's trying to make money.
And social change.
And social change. Yeah, we haven't talked about her
change.
As a... Yeah. Yeah, but very much a political figure. And yeah. I think to a certain degree, like, identifies not without a great deal of ego strength as a kind of an American prophet. I think that she would probably say that's kind of a piece that she embraces, certainly from the Hebrew tradition that shaped her. She's got a healthy sense of the art. Well, I mean, kind of her famous Yale address was, "The artist is a... As a social commentator." I think she sees a social political role for the artist, speaking truth to power, we might say, which is one way of thinking about what a prophet does. So I want to take her seriously in those terms too. There is a political agenda to her shows, to her material, particularly around questions of gender and power. That's some of the stuff that I'm particularly interested in looking at as we look at
both Yentl and The Way We Were are
very much about
hugely
women,
important, hugely important
yeah,
about women,
how women
spiritual
can exercise power.
And political power and the intersection between the two of them. I have so many questions.
Lots
so
to talk
to
about.
Talk about.
Lent with Barbara. She's going to be my Lent companion this year. We're not going to make this a strictly Lenten podcast because we want it to be able to be listened to at any time of year, regardless of you might be doing Advent with Barbara, you might be doing Summer with Barbara. But I do sort of feel like there's something really interesting to me about a 970-page autobiography. I'm listening to it, as you mentioned. It's 48 hours of my life that I will, by the end of this experience, have spent in the company of Barbra. And I mean, for those of you our listeners who haven't picked up the book yet, I highly recommend the recorded version because she basically just uses it as she performs her own autobiography. She is constantly riffing, doing little aside like it's still not a finished work. She's still not done with it, right? Like even in the recording studio, I'm presuming with the galleys in front of her, she is still adding stories, adding little snide remarks to her text. So she is in the moment still working with her own autobiography. It's taken her 20 years to put together, and still changing it, still updating it, still very much in the moment as just her and a mic. And an imaginary listener, I suppose, as she performs the character Barbra Streisand, such an amazing Barbra Streisand. I mean, I enjoy her company. I find her strange. I find her sometimes a little kooky in that sort of celebrity way where it's like this woman has not been grounded in actual human experience for 40 years. And that shows sometime, you know, like the comforting privilege of having money and
so
like,
much
you know, like
money.
So much money. So I sometimes find her a little odd in that way. And I am so interested and compelled by this actor, by this incredible performer and human being who I think does say something really interesting about art and creativity and spirituality.
So we hope you come along for the ride.
Yeah.
And let us know what you think.
Everybody said don't, but we're going to do it anyway.
We're going to do it anyway. Good to be back.
Good to be back with you. Looking forward to this.
Till next time. Bye.
The Gospel of Musical Theater is a production of Trinity Episcopal Cathedral in Portland, Oregon. Join Peter and Nathan every other Friday right here in your podcast feed and connect with us on Instagram and Twitter @GospelOfMT. Learn more and support us at trinity-episcopal.org/podcasts. See you next time!